Hello, and welcome to Discussions with Deepak. I'm Ngozi Ndelue, Deepak's Senior Director of Research and Special Projects. This is the first installment of the Death Penalty Information Center's Rethinking Public Safety series of episodes. In this series, we will talk with people who have spent their careers working for public safety. We'll learn more about their careers and how their work has shaped their views on the death penalty. Our guest today is Jim Petro, former Ohio Attorney General and the co-author of False Justice, Eight Myths That Convict the Innocent, written with his wife, writer and advocate, Nancy Petro. His 40-year legal career included litigating cases in venues from Mayor's Court to the United States Supreme Court. He has a long history of public service, serving as Ohio Auditor of State, Ohio Attorney General, and Chancellor of the Ohio Board of Regents. In 28 years as an elected official, he also served as a city councilman, a county commissioner, and a state representative. Welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Now, we're going to be talking about issues regarding innocence and wrongful conviction in general, and then kind of focus on the death penalty. And you've been concerned about the fact that our legal system doesn't always get it right. And as a result, innocent people have been and continue to be convicted. As Ohio Attorney General, you took an active role in supporting the exoneration of Clarence Elkins, a wrongfully convicted man serving a life sentence. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
You know, for me, the case of Clarence Elkins was truly kind of an earth-shaking event, because I never really, having even been a prosecutor, I never really thought that the system would fail so miserably as to convict and incarcerate for many years a person absolutely innocent of the crime. In the case of Clarence Elkins, I had a call one day. I was the attorney general working in my office, and I had a call from a very respected state legislator who was actually sitting by the phone with the director of the Ohio Innocence Project. And he explained to me the case of Clarence Elkins and pointed out that recent additional DNA testing that was done while Clarence was in prison and without the approval of the prison authorities, in any event, that DNA testing would reveal that Clarence was the wrong person. He was not the person who was directly involved in the homicide. And I was kind of shocked that that could be true. But learning more a little bit over the next day or two, getting a couple of my staff members involved, it became very clear that this man had been in prison for 7 years. He had a long way to go on a life sentence, but he was absolutely innocent of the crime. And it was DNA that actually conclusively proved his innocence. Again, it was remarkable, I think, only because of DNA would he have been exonerated without DNA testing and the advances that have occurred because of that. He may have spent the rest of his life in prison wrongfully. So it was a remarkable experience. It was probably the most eye-opening experience of my life.
And then even after leaving office as the Attorney General, you worked pro bono with the Ohio Innocence Project and supported legislation to reduce the likelihood of wrongful convictions. Why did you continue this work?
Well, I was concerned. I mean, when I left office as Attorney General, my desire to see public policy move in the right direction didn't change. I mean, in my years as a state legislator, as a state auditor, as the Attorney General of Ohio, I always wanted to make sure that government was doing things right. We weren't functioning in a fashion that made a lot of mistakes. And so when I learned that the justice system was prone to error, I really wanted to continue to do whatever I could try to make that better. And I think that was even in my days where I was simply a public, a lawyer, you know, in private practice after I left government. I still did a lot of work on a pro bono basis, assist in wrongful conviction matters. And I think that's important for people to be involved in that, recognizing that wrongful convictions aren't infrequent. They occur more often than I would ever have imagined.
And in your book, False Justice, one of the myths that you discuss is that conviction errors get corrected on appeal. As you know, this myth is often repeated when people claim that the death penalty is being fairly administered and there are too many appeals in death penalty cases. Can you explain why there could be many appeals, but you will still end up with wrongful convictions and death sentences that go unremitted?
I will tell you honestly, the appeal process really doesn't look carefully at the facts that were presented at trial. It looks at instead at procedural matters and other matters that really don't deal with the finding of fact by a jury. If a jury reaches a conclusion and it results in a penalty that could be as severe as a death penalty, that's not necessarily the issue that's looked at most carefully on appeal. It's procedural things, it's factual things, but not even to the same extent. There are many occasions we discovered where people were convicted the maximum penalty, and later, as all of the elements of the case began to be fully vetted, it was determined that the person was potentially innocent. And that's essentially the role that the Innocence Project filled so aggressively. When I first learned of the wrongful conviction of an individual in Ohio, the Innocence Project was just getting moving, just getting off the ground. Since that time, they have really, I think, did a great deal to improve the success of the criminal justice system, because they're out there. There's not enough of them, but the Innocence Projects broadly are out there taking on cases where innocence was more likely than not, pursuing those cases.
We recently released a report about wrongfully convicted people on death row. The Innocence Epidemic Report was released this February, and we looked at the 185 death penalty exonerations that have occurred since 1973.
Amazing.
That includes 11 in Ohio. Yeah, and there were some really stark findings. First, that 69% of wrongful capital convictions involved official misconduct, and that includes governmental, police, and prosecutorial misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
We also found that official misconduct is more prevalent in the cases of defendants of color, with misconduct present in 3/4 of the cases of Black death row exonerees and 2/3 of the cases of Latinx death row exonerees. Given the continued presence of official misconduct in death penalty exonerations, I think our report really supports one of the points that you've made, where you say that one of the myths about wrongful conviction is that they result from innocent human error. Can you talk about that myth and what role prosecutors need to play in preventing and remedying wrongful convictions?
You know, I believe over the last decade, there is a deeper awareness, even on the part of law enforcement and prosecution, there's a greater risk of error than previously had been the case. And I would say that those instances where a conviction was in error, I think it was, in some cases, despite kind of well-meaning efforts at accuracy on the part of law enforcement and prosecution. I don't know that it's been my experience that law enforcement or the prosecutor really is willingly presenting something that they believe to be false, but they're doing so in order to win. I don't doubt that happens occasionally. But I think the greater error is a desire to, when you've indicted someone, you feel you've got a case. and then their desire to, your advocacy, succeed in getting the result which you think is correct, conviction of the crime for which the person's been charged. What we've learned is that the mistakes are made even without the intent more often than we like to think, and that there's even occasionally someone who skirts the truth in order to get a win, for example, from someone they think is just a bad actor. And that's really, to me, a gross error on the part of the system when that occurs. In both cases, the government, prosecutors, law enforcement, have made a mistake, and that's something that needs to be part of the system, where the watchfulness of every level, both in the trial phase, the appellate phase, that people are watching carefully the telltale signs that something could be wrong from a factual standpoint, and this individual may not be guilty. They need to make sure that the system is working to its greatest degree to avoid the risk of a wrongful conviction.
Just a follow-up to that about what happens on the back end after somebody is convicted and how hard it can be to recognize that wrongful convictions happen. I just noticed there the Ohio Attorney General's capital case report just came out last week, and there was this discussion about exoneration and saying, oh, only one person who has actually been exonerated is credibly actually innocent. But that's in a situation where we have folks who have kind of won civil suits around actual innocence who were death row exonerees. You know, Joe D'Ambrosio is a case where there's all this evidence of significant misconduct. So what do you say when years down the line where there's so much evidence of wrongful conviction, you're getting so much resistance to the idea of kind of accepting that the system has made a mistake?
When you raise the case of Joe D'Ambrosio, you know, there's a case where there was significant misconduct on the part of the prosecution. That can't be tolerated. The system of justice under prosecutors, judges, every part of that has to be examining every bit of evidence to assure that there's the highest degree of accuracy in that evidence, that there's nothing that's been fudged or taken to an extreme that would make that evidence really subject to significant doubt. And so that's really part of the system that really needs to be underscored at every level. We can't undertake a prosecution where we know there's some significant risk this individual may not have committed the crime. We have to be extraordinarily aware of that risk on the prosecution side.
And I want to turn a little bit to the legislative role that you had. So in kind of the evolution of your understanding of the death penalty, as a state legislator, you supported the bill to reinstate Ohio's death penalty in 1981.
Yes.
After the United States Supreme Court had declared the capital punishment law unconstitutional, and you continued to support it during your term as Ohio Attorney General. But that changed this year. You co-wrote an op-ed arguing that Ohio should repeal the death penalty. Could you talk about that evolution? What changed your opinion?
Well, in reality, you understand, I actually supervised 19 executions. That wasn't an easy thing. And it was my own internal view and the view with my staff, where I made it clear as we were approaching these things, I had a group, a death penalty unit of lawyers and investigators, and I would ask that we kind of re-examine this so that within the Attorney General's office, we were confident the actual crime as charged and convicted did occur, and it was at that level of significance that the death penalty was warranted. And so we had a conscious effort to make sure that we were doing the right thing in conforming with the law. You made a question that went back in history. You know, Ohio's death penalty was struck down, as was the death penalties across the country in 1978. And 1981, I was in my first year as a state legislator. I was a young man, 31 years old. I'd been a prosecutor, been a private lawyer. And when I say prosecutor, I was assistant county prosecutor in Columbus, Ohio. And I was city prosecutor in Rocky River, Ohio, when I went back to northern Ohio to begin a private law practice, because that was my home area. At that time, I didn't even suspect that when death penalties were handed down, they actually could have been an error. I presume that the system was so tightly handled, the risk of an error, of a conviction error in a death penalty case, was almost impossible to imagine. And later began to learn that that was not the case. First of all, conviction error did occur. Second of all, it occurred in all cases, whether they were death penalty cases or life imprisonment cases. Mistakes did occur. And in a death penalty case, there's no reversing it. I mean, once it may have happened, and I know that in the history of the death penalty, people have been executed wrongfully. I can't pinpoint the case, but there's no doubt, because of the reality of wrongful conviction, the recognition that I have now that, you know, in the great scheme of things, the criminal justice system does make mistakes that are not corrected on appeal. They're factual mistakes, and they result in wrongful conviction in spite of the fact that the case is appealed all the way up, even. That may not change things. And so if that is true, which I believe it is, then there are individuals who have been executed who are totally innocent of crimes. I'm sure of it.
And is that what really changed your opinion about the death penalty?
Yes, that's part of it. A recognition that the criminal justice system isn't perfect, and so that the ultimate penalty, a penalty of death, is potentially something that could go wrong, and we can't afford that. So, you know, where the mistake is on someone who's in prison for life, at least they might get their life back when there is recognition of innocence as a result of conviction error.
Now, one of the reasons that people who support the death penalty say that capital punishment is important is that it deters violent crime. How does that mesh with your experiences as a prosecutor and then as the state's top law enforcement official?
I came to believe, even as a prosecutor, that the death penalty, and when I was a prosecutor, I was much younger. It was my first job out of law school. I was in my mid-20s. I didn't have a moral objection to the death penalty, even to the extent that I do today. But I was concerned, as I learned that errors occurred, that the death penalty couldn't be, you know, once it's been enforced, the issue is over in that case. And if you made a mistake, it's the greatest law of all in the system, execute an innocent person. You mentioned Joe D'Ambrosio. There's a very good example. I mean, without a good lawyer and some facts kind of coming to bear, Joe D'Ambrosio was convicted and sentenced to death, as I remember.
Yes.
That was a long time ago.
Yep.
But as I remember, that was the outcome. You know, that those are the things that really concern you when you consider the flaws that can occur in the justice system. I don't doubt there have been many, many instances of innocent people being convicted and then executed. I can't pinpoint one, but I don't doubt that it's happened.
What do you think, whether you think that the death penalty actually deters violent crime. Do you see the death penalty as actually being useful for public safety?
There was a time I thought that could be the case, but the more I've examined it over the years, I don't really see it as a deterrent. I don't think it has been a deterrent. I don't think it deters violent crime. I suppose remotely there could be an instance where someone commits a crime that would have been a more serious crime on their part, but they didn't take that next step because they were concerned about highest penalty being something that could be held against them. I don't think that really happens. So I don't think the death penalty is a deterrent to violent or serious crime.
And then, I mean, right now we're kind of coming out of this pandemic and states and counties are really focusing on kind of the budget impact and what is next. So the question about cost has come up a lot. You've served as a state representative, a county commissioner, and as the Ohio Auditor of State. Has your experience managing government budgets affected your perspective on the financial costs of the death penalty?
Well, you know, the thing that's so interesting is very often people say they want a death penalty because they don't want to have to pay for someone being in prison for all those years as a life imprisoned incarceree because they're paying all this money to keep them in prison. It's cheaper to kill them. No, it's not. Every study that's ever been undertaken would indicate very clearly that the cost of punishment through death is far greater than punishment of life in prison without parole, because the cost of a death penalty and the appeals and the risks and all of the things that come along with that cost is greater than life in prison without parole.
Ohio is at an interesting place with the death penalty right now. Ohio just became the only state in the nation that specifically exempts the seriously mentally ill from being executed.
Yes.
Or sentenced to death. And also the legislature is currently considering abolishing the death penalty altogether.
I'm encouraging that, by the way.
A question that I had is kind of how public opinion has evolved. A poll released in January 2021 found that a majority of Ohioans, including 48% of Republicans, support replacing the death penalty with a life sentence. Why do you think Ohioans are rethinking the death penalty?
Over the years, it's been so clear that the death penalty is a process that so uses the resources of the courts and of law enforcement for such a long period. When we've seen people who are actually executed, and again, I supervised 19 of them, every one of those individuals had gone through 15 to 25 years of appeals and costly seeking of remedies to try to avoid being executed. Most of all that by government is fairly overwhelming. To have convicted that individual of life in prison and then putting them in prison without the extraordinary appeals and the extraordinary additional legal engagements that occur is much, much more expensive. So often people, voters would say to me, well, the death penalty is good because, you know, you don't want to keep them in jail for all those years and have to pay for them. And I would have to explain to them it's much cheaper to keep a convicted criminal who's convicted of a serious maximum penalty offense. It's much cheaper to keep them in prison for life than to go through the process ultimately executing them. So that's the argument that people would make, that, well, we don't want to pay for them to be in prison forever when we could just kill them. That doesn't work. That doesn't work that way.
And do you think that the awareness about some of the mistakes that the criminal legal system has made has also affected people's opinions about the death penalty?
Probably to a lesser degree than the financial side. I don't know that too many people come back and argue that the death penalty is dangerous because there's the risk of conviction error that would potentially bring about the execution of an innocent person. I don't know if people think about that too much. I think about it because in a real sense, as a lawyer who's been engaged in a lot of cases that involve wrongful conviction, I know they occur, and they occur much more frequently than you'd ever want to admit. The system itself is not perfect. We should strive to make it as perfect as possible. There's always the risk of imperfection, and if imperfection results in a death penalty, then obviously that's the greatest injustice of all.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been an education for me, and I know it will be for our listeners. For listeners to learn more about the death penalty, you can visit the DPIC website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. And to make sure you never miss an episode of our podcast, you can subscribe to Discussions with DPIC on your podcast app of choice. Thanks again, Jim.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed having the opportunity to speak with you.